Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is illustrator and author Keith Henry Brown. There is music in illustration. There is color in music. There is improvisation in both. Music and illustration share a long, rich history, and there is quite a bit illustrators today can learn from it. Among other topics, Keith explains how music has played a vital role in both his life and art. With an assist from Miles Davis, Keith shares what it means to feel entitled to your mistakes and how that applies to creativity. And we discuss the importance of embracing your individuality, whether you are a musician or illustrator. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Do you still have a 6-foot-tall poster of Vampirella?
I don't think you're going to ask the most important question first.
That is definitely the most important question.
You know what? I had one maybe about 12 years ago. I reordered it, or I bought it off eBay. I can't remember which. Yeah. And I totally had it in my... I had an apartment, and my boys... I had got divorced, and my boys were... I had my own apartment for the first time in years since my kids were born.
Right.
And I had one in my, like, a studio area, in addition to their own rooms, and I kept it in there. I had all my crap in there. I had my action figures, I had my superhero
nice.
Stuff, I had
yep.
my music, I had all my cool posters, and yes, on the back of a door, I had a 6-foot Vampirella poster,
tight.
Which most of the time was closed so they couldn't see it.
Right. I mean, well,
but I love
what
it,
happened
you know
to the
that.
Original when you were a kid? Was it trashed?
Oh, man, my mom hated that poster. She was so upset with me when she saw it. She was just like, Keith, you just know you cannot have that on your wall. And I said, it's just not nice. And because I had, you know, I had the Farrah Fawcett. All of it. And it was just too many of that. I had also had Bruce Lee, and I had the Beatles. But apparently
that's all good.
I mean, you know, when you're a kid, you're that age, you don't even realize that how you have this.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
To me, it was like, I read the comics, and I like, and she's cool, and I like her. You're not even sure of your own.
Oh no!
Knowledge.
Oh my God! We're enjoying that now. You know, my kids are like teen and preteen, and they'll say some combination of words that is incredibly sexual, that unintentional. You know,
exactly.
I'm not even going to make an example here because, you know, keep this podcast PG-13 rated. But anyway. And then Sarah and I, you know, well, one of us will just jump up and be like, oh, you don't say that. And then they're like, well, why?
That.
Why can't I say that? And then we're scrambling for an explanation. Well, you see, you know what? Just don't say that. And that's as far as we go right now.
That's about my mom. I mean, she was a church going lady,
uh-huh.
and she just kept saying, that's just not nice. And I said, why not? What's wrong with it? It's just not nice. You should not have that. I don't want people coming here and seeing that. And I was like, oh,
right.
Okay.
Your mom was a musician, right?
She was a singer.
Yeah.
Although she never did it professionally. She used to sing at church.
Mm-hmm.
And she did get accepted at Juilliard at one point. But my grandfather couldn't afford to send my two other aunts and my mom to school. So he could only afford to send one. So she didn't get to take the Juilliard trip. She still wanted to come to New York eventually. They're from North Carolina. But she used to sing around the house, and mm-hmm. just beautiful voice, you know, like Aretha Franklin or something, you know. But I think she always regretted that she never was able to develop it.
Interesting about the Juilliard connection, because I have a question coming up, and it kind of ties into someone else who went to Juilliard, which we'll
mm-hmm.
touch on in a half a second. And I know you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And obviously she introduced you to music. I mean, like, when were you like first introduced to jazz?
Well, you know, we had a lot of records in our house, you know, a lot of show tunes. I could still sing every single tune from My Fair Lady and Oklahoma.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Jazz came a little later for me. My best friend, who was always more sophisticated than me, smarter than me, more talented than me, better looking than me, but loved me, like it's almost like his protege, even though we're the same age.
Mm-hmm.
It was still my best friend. He played John Coltrane's record, and it was My Favorite Things.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew the song My Favorite Things, you know, from
mm-hmm.
Sound of Music, mm-hmm. but I never heard anyone play it that way. And I was just like, he's doing a song, but then he's doing something else. I think I was like 14. And I just thought it was incredible how he could make what felt like 10 songs out of one song and have maybe so much music going on, and that the melody became less important and what he was doing became more important. And I just said, and then I saw on a cover, I mean, it was a black guy, and I was like, wow, it's an African American guy, and he's playing like this, and he's like an artist or something. He's not trying to get on radio or anything. He's playing what he wants, what he feels. And that became like kind of like my template for everything I do, I think, from that time.
I didn't get into jazz until college, and I think it was sophomore year. It wasn't even freshman year. I mean, freshman year I was listening to like the Pulp Fiction soundtrack and Massive Attack, but then sophomore year got it a little bit more into jazz and classical stuff. And of course, like one of my first introductions, if maybe not the first, was, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, obviously. I mean, pretty universally acknowledged as one of the best, if not the best, jazz albums of all time. And so fast forward 30 years or whatever, however long it is, and I get made fun of by my family for listening too much to it.
Were you in a smoking jacket with a pipe too while you were
I want to be in my head. I very much am, very, very much am, but not in reality. So we'll talk more about Miles Davis in a half sec, but before we get to that, let me get something straight here. Around New Year's Eve, I think I might have the dates wrong, but you tell me. Around New Year's Eve or New Year's, around the end of the year, 2016, 2017, somewhere around there, you decide to pursue children's book illustration as a possible career. And before that, you were design manager for Churchill Downs, creative director at Jazz at Lincoln Center. You're basically in the marketing and promotional design game up until that point. Within weeks, you pick up an agent. You receive a call or an email maybe from Page Street Kids that they want you to illustrate a book about Miles Davis, of all people. So then a year later, Birth of Cool is published. It was your first book. It promptly earned a star review from Kirkus, which is not the easiest thing to get, by the way. I mean, people have dropped mics for less. You know what I'm saying? Like you kind of hit it running. The question, I guess, is what led you to making that move? Was it
First of all,
a clean break, or was it like a transition out of full, like more of a full-time thing? Like, how did that?
it's a transition. It's
Okay.
still a transition. I also want to say your reportage, you're going back and looking at my career. It's incredible. I'm shocked. You remember things I almost don't remember. That's amazing. Your research.
I have ways, my friend.
I'm actually shocked a little bit, but yeah, I very close to that. I think I just decided that I don't want to be doing advertising, design stuff for the rest of my life. It was really a detour because I always wanted to do the drawing and I wanted to do the art, but I had to take care of a family and I needed health insurance and all that. And the one thing that I probably don't say that much is that, or not enough, I would say, is that before I did it, I actually, when I decided I want to try to be an illustrator of some kind, I had a graphic novel that I was trying to get out, and I was trying to find someone who might be an agent. And one of the first people I called was somebody who was once one of your guests on the show, which is Ella Lupo. And Ella Lupo, who's a very dear friend of mine, who I love, and she asked me. I mean, I sent her my stuff, and I said, "What do you think?" And I think it just wasn't fitting the style of her house, and she was very polite, and she just said, "You know what? I'm sure you'll get picked up by somebody, and just stick with it. I know you can do it." And very polite response. Then. And then she wrote me back again, said, "I've been thinking about you, and maybe you should do this and that." She gave me more advice, so I went and got an agent, which was Andrea Brown. And actually, though, I got in the Miles even right almost simultaneously when Andrea Brown decided to bring me on. So even with or without him, I would have probably gotten that gig. And by the way, I was so naive about the whole business that I didn't even read the script. I just said, Miles Davis, I'm doing it. You know, I don't care. I don't care if it was the worst script ever. It's my chance to break into the business.
Sure.
And it's well within my what I felt I could do. But I think the reason why I wanted to do it was because, you know, I had done comics and some storytelling stuff. And I love storytelling. And I love the idea of having a, you know, like sort of like this tangible object that somebody can hold in their hand and look at and mm-hmm. hold that has my
sure.
drawings in it and have mm-hmm. my name on it, you know. And I said, you know, I don't know that much about kids' books, but I actually went to the library and bought a bunch of books about how to do, you know, storytelling and how to do children's books. And mm-hmm. I looked at them for like 20 minutes and said, well, I'm too lazy and bored to read them all. So I just took things from certain ones and then I just started doing it. And I was just so happy that it ended up being a really beautiful script. And right. I didn't even know what a star review was or why it was important.
Yeah, those things are rare.
I was surprised because I didn't even know it was such a big deal until somebody explained it to me. Said I was that odd.
Yeah, Kirkus is known for, I think, more for their snark than their starred reviews. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're more likely to get like a kind of a side-eye review than a starred review. Way more likely. You know, it's like, oh, this book is really nice. Too bad they used the color blue, though. And then that's the review. I mean, they're historically now. I mean, it's a comical at this point how, like, some. I don't know
what. Does anybody know what is the basis of their criteria?
I have no idea.
It definitely gave me some confidence. Like, okay, well, maybe I don't completely suck at this.
So then this book comes out. This is 2018. It's been a few years. And, I mean, it seems to me by looking at your portfolio that, I mean, music is very much a part of like who you are, your DNA, your background, your interest. And so a lot of that sort of weaves its way into your work. That's safe to say, right?
It's safe to say. Sometimes it's a liability, but I can't help it.
In other words, like you think that might pigeonhole you or put you in a box of some kind?
Yeah. I mean, but I can't help it. A lot of my friends are musicians. My kids are musicians. I love music.
Yeah.
And it's just a thing that keeps me going. It keeps me inspired.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how the world could exist without it.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about illustration and music. I tend to use music as a way of explaining properties of illustration, especially with composition, mm-hmm. page turns and books, you know, like, page turns, like what you decide to do, whether it's a spot or a full page or a spread, it's a lot like eighth notes, quarter notes, whole notes. It's a beat. So it's like spot, spot, full page, long spread, spot, spot, page, spread, spread. I mean, it's like almost like a song. It just got me to thinking about it and doing research for this conversation. There's a lot of like musicality to illustration and writing. But let's just focus on illustration for a minute, like musicality to illustration. So back to Miles Davis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Blue and Green is my favorite, or one of my favorites. Piece by Bill Evans is my favorite. But like Blue and Green by Miles Davis is one of my favorite jazz
gorgeous
records of all time. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. that song could have been called Week Old Hot Trash. And I think I'd still see blue. I would literally see blues and greens with my eyes closed. Muted. Yeah. It feels like the blues and greens you would see on like a rainy spring day. That's what it feels like to me when I hear that song. I mean, there is color in music. And that's not a novel thought. I mean, it's commonplace way of describing music in the music world. In fact, I looked this up. I'm like, is it? I mean, where does this come from? So I looked it up. So you probably already know this, and this has probably been brought up in conversation with your family and friends and stuff, but color is actually a term in music, otherwise known as timbre. I did not know that. And it includes all aspects of a sound that do not have anything to do with how high or low that sound is, or how loud or soft it is, or how long or short it is. How beautiful is that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, musicians often talk about in terms of colors.
Yeah.
Just casually. It's not even something they think about. Miles Davis very specifically did an album some years ago called Aura.
Uh-huh.
And every tune on there is a different color. Yeah, red, blue, yellow, green. You know, it's how they see it in their head, you know?
Right.
And I also think sometimes when I do stuff you know, especially if I'm not doing anything specifically other than just doing it for myself, I will pick colors that I'm thinking about what the music sounds like. I mean, I'm not trained, you know, like some people I know, and but I do tend to see music in colors, you know. So when I do things like album covers and stuff, you know, I'm thinking, you know, when I'm playing the record first before I start drawing it, I'm thinking, well, this, it sounds like this. Now, it's a language that's kind of specific, because I don't know that if a musician hears something in a certain color, the other musician necessarily agrees that that's the same color they're hearing it. So it's more of a feeling, I think. You know, it's just another way of describing it. I used to write a lot of jazz reviews, and I will sometimes use colors as a way to describe music, because it's very hard to describe music. It's just, you know, it's indescribable. So all you can do is usually either compare it to other music or use words or terms that suggest it, and hopefully somebody will see it in their mind's eye what you're trying to describe. But it's difficult sometimes to visualize or talk about music, because it's one thing I love about it, is that it is so subjective to the listener.
Just like illustration. I mean, I wonder what else, like, how can illustrators, like, what's the takeaway? Is there a takeaway for illustrators?
For me, it's like improvisation, you know?
Yeah.
To me, the highest art is improvisation. You know, whether you're a stand-up comedian, you know, or you're an actor, whatever art you do, you know, I don't I don't think that much about what colors I use, in for better or worse. I almost take no time, you know, when it comes to, like, some people will come up with whole color schemes for how the whole thing will do, and they'll do it in you know, you'll see films that are like, they have color correctors and everything, that people that spend a lot of time making sure there's a certain tone to the art. Think about, I mean, I have an overall idea about what I'll be thinking about if I'm doing a picture or a book or an illustration, but it's all spontaneous. I usually don't think about, as a matter of fact, I'm always worried that I don't want to think about it too much. So I'll give myself a little bit, which to me is almost like, say you want to do a version of a Gershwin tune, like say it's Someone to Watch Over Me. You know, people have done thousands of versions of that. So most musicians, Keith Jarrett, Miles Davis, you know, who are Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington, they all know this tune. But they don't know how they're going to play it when they're in front of an audience, especially a live audience, but also in a studio. And then they know the tune, the rest of the band knows the tune, but they don't know how they're going to play it necessarily, unless the whole arrangement's already been written out. But a lot of times it hasn't been. So you know what you're going to do, but you're not sure how it's going to go, which is why I love watercolor too. Because I don't know exactly how the water's going to go. It might not go the way I want, and then I have to figure out how to make it work. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. I got to start over. But I still try. There's a great, In Kind of Blue, the album that you love so much, on the original LP, and you may have seen this, Will Evans writes about the music on the album. He does this beautiful essay. And the essay is about how he equates modal music, which is the type of music that is in Kind of Blue, which was basically created on the spot by Miles and Bill, who also wrote a lot of the tunes and didn't get credit, by the way. He wrote at least all the tunes. Yeah, he didn't. Miles, you know, he wasn't always a nice guy. he took credit for things he didn't do occasionally. But I mean, but he equated it with Japanese watercolor painting.
Get out of here.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
And you can find that probably pretty easily.
Yeah.
Online, and it's beautifully written too, which is surprising because I'm not known for being a writer. But so I see that. I see what he meant by that, which is, you have control, but you don't have control. And it's sometimes hard to do that when you have to do assignments and stuff, you know. You know, but it also kind of has kept me from doing digital so far. I think I could probably achieve the same thing in digital. I just haven't made the transition yet.
So you're in a rich history of illustrators and painters who have created jazz albums over the years. David Stone Martin being one of them.
Yes.
Ben Shawn, Andy Warhol.
Yes.
Someone who maybe is a little less known is Olga Albizu. She was a Puerto Rican abstract expressionist, and her painting is the painting you see on the cover of Goetz Gilberto. That
I
like
love that piece.
orange and black one, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, super familiar. Yep.
Yeah. The
I
funny
love that
story.
record. Oh, the whole
I
series.
mean,
Great.
yeah, totally. A funny story about that. So she was in New York. I think she had like temped at RCA, so maybe she made a friend at RCA. And this friend was an assistant to the head of the record division. And the friend had hung Albizu's work in the office. The executives noticed. The rest is history. That's how her painting ended up on the
Wow.
cover. Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that
I
wild?
never knew that.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway.
Brilliant. I didn't know that.
Yep. One of my favorite illustrators is Romare Bearden.
Oh, yes.
I'm as a collage artist myself, his work just resonates with me in ways I can't fully articulate. It's said that he was a jazz enthusiast too, but it was said that he spoke about jazz and creativity as in the same way as basically for both. It's like with jazz and with creativity, you're basically making a move. It's what you were just saying. It's like you're making a move and then responding to that move. That's
Yeah, I
what
mean,
I
and
think
you
is the
can,
essence of embracing the process.
sure. And I mean, and by the way, you can make a mess doing that.
Sure.
I've seen cats playing, and a guy starts a solo, he's doing something, and the band's following him, and all of a sudden he puts himself down a hole and he can't get out of it, and he's trying to complete the solo and he can't do it logically, and and it's like he just bows out and just turns around with his head bowed in shame, like, "Hey, sorry guys, I screwed up, I fucked up,"
Yeah.
and I do that all the time, and I won't tell you which pieces I've done books wise that I've done when I feel like shit actually got printed that way because I couldn't fix
Don't
it in
tell
time.
Kirkus. He'll take the star review away.
Yeah, Kirkus, Mr. Kirkus or Mrs. Kirkus, but I do think again for better or worse. I mean, everything's it's like to use a cliche, it's like walking a live a wire. Because I don't know. I mean, I feel like if I'm going to do everything all perfectly, then I might as well be working, doing pharmaceutical advertising, where we go every single thing 50,000 times and make sure everything's absolutely perfect and we chest test everything about a millimeter, even though I know I'm doing stuff that's supposed to be printed and it's published and people are paying for it to get made. I still feel like I'm entitled to my mistakes. That's my style. If
Yeah.
people don't like my mistakes, if the hand looks funny or the head looks funny, the colors are off. The paint's mixing in weird places. It's like, okay, well then maybe I'm not for you.
Right.
And occasionally, I try not to do this, but when I clearly read reviews of my work, and it's somebody said, I just don't like Keith Brown's art on this. I like this story, but I don't like Keith Brown's art. And I'm like, that's cool because not for everybody.
Yeah,
Not
right.
everybody likes jazz musicians. I mean,
Right.
people love Miles, people love John Coltrane. I had some John Coltrane stuff, LPs that you probably would stand because it's just him basically screaming, on his horn for 20 minutes. And some of that stuff I love, some of it I don't. But
Yeah,
he
I
was that's
prefer the
where he
quieter
was at
stuff.
that
I prefer like Blue Train, Lush Life, like a little bit short, a little more
Yeah.
chill.
Yeah.
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 I mean,
And that's okay
I
too.
yeah.
I mean,
No,
it's
yeah, no.
the same way with pop music, I mean, I've got some, I mean, I love Stevie Wonder on today's his birthday, but later in his career, he did like five records that were absolutely fucking extraordinarily beautiful and brilliant. And then later in his career, he started doing some weird electronic sounding, not electronic, but very stiff sounding stuff. And he just didn't seem to have the same
Oh my God.
feeling in it anymore.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, man. Because that when you said I love Stevie Wonder, the first thought in my head was like, well, his early stuff was good, but his later stuff sucked. Yeah.
It's like there's a scene from the movie with John Cusack, I think it's called, the one
High Fidelity.
about him, High Fidelity.
Is that the one with
And
the record
Jack,
store?
right, and
Yeah.
Jack Black,
Yeah,
some
yeah.
guy comes in the house, and Jack Black says, the guy says, "I want you to get a record for my daughter." And he goes, "Well, what do you want?" He goes, "I just called to love you by Stevie Wonder."
Yeah.
And then he says, Jack Black says, "Dude, there's no fucking way she likes that song."
Oh my God, we got to watch that movie again. I haven't seen it. It's obviously based on the Nick Hornby book, right?
Right.
I haven't
And
read
they
that
did a
book, and I
TV
keep
series
meaning
too
to.
with Zoe Kravitz too, bizarrely. They did a remake of it with her playing the John Cusack part.
Oh, dang. I didn't know that.
It's
All
kind of
right,
nice.
got to catch that too. Shoot. All right.
Yeah.
Speaking of being perfect and making mistakes, I'm sure you know this, but I mean, Miles Davis was a pretty quotable guy. He dropped some
Yes.
doozies, right? And
Yep.
one that I like, just because it applies to how I overcame depression, is my future starts when I wake up every morning. I don't know if he said it. I didn't hear him say it, but it's a quote attributed to him. It's a great quote. My future starts when I wake up every morning. How fucking awesome is that? The second one is, and to your point, do not fear mistakes. There are none.
Exactly. I live by that. Yeah, I don't think he meant
mathematics, right?
Grammar. Or driving your bike over someone's feet or something.
Exactly.
You know, but yeah, in the creative
gun maintenance.
World,
yeah.
Totally. yeah. Along those lines. Yeah, I do think that. And by the way, there's a lot of artists who paint, at least in my mind, illustrators otherwise, who seem like everything they do is perfect. You know, like Joe Chiodello, like Gary Kelly, who's another god of mine, like Brad Holland. You know, there's a lot of these people who, when I look at their work, it just looks like absolute perfection. But I'm guessing that, you know, they had to break a lot of eggs, you know, to make those omelets, you know?
Yeah. My feeling is like everyone knows, like everyone's making mistakes in their paintings, right? Like one of my favorite contemporary children's book illustrators is Lauren Long. Lauren Long is one of the great current children's book painters, period. And, you know, it's a crime that hasn't won basically like, you know, half a dozen Caldecotts at this point. But I bet you, I haven't spoken to him about this, but I bet you to look at his work, you'd think like, man, that is precision and perfection. But I bet you he looks at his paintings and goes like, well, that's a mistake. I think everybody has mistakes in their work, but maybe 100% of us have mistakes in our work. 100%. There's mistakes in this podcast episode that I'm hearing myself making. Do people hear it? No, but I hear it. And I think that applies 100% across the board with any creative endeavor. But what percentage of us admit it? 10? Imagine if 100% of us admitted all the mistakes that we make with our work publicly, how much better everyone would feel. Like, oh, shoot, really? That's a mistake? Okay, great. I saw somebody post.
Tell me that I shouldn't say that. I say too much.
I don't know, man. God, especially in this world, especially these days, can we just all be fucking honest and like truthful and just real?
Exactly.
That would be great. That would be
swell. Like a guy like Floyd Cooper who just passed away. I mean, his work looks flawless.
Yeah, podcast guest. I'm so thankful.
I'm going to listen to that.
Oh my God, so thankful.
I mean, he's another one of those guys that I just look up to like crazy. I mean, it's, but you know, a lot of work got there. And by the way, they got the desired effect. They did whatever it is they did to get to that point, to what we see, was the, you know, whatever, the trial and error, the sketches, the, you know, but even then, I'm sure, I can't imagine anybody looking at stuff after it's been done and say, it's genius. I remember looking at reading an interview with Orson Welles, talking about Citizen Kane or Magnificent Ambersons, and he, you know, to him, it's just a jumble of mistakes and missed opportunities and lack of budget and, you know, I actually think, honestly, that if you had everything in front of you and you could have as much time as you want, you could do it exactly the way you want, it's going to be some crappy ass art.
Agreed.
I think you need the limitations. I think you need the mistakes. I think you need whatever, the roughness, in order to feel. I mean, look at Basquiat, you know? I mean,
oh my God.
You can't, I mean, there's a perfection to it, but there's also chaos to a lot of it, you know?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I guess there are probably artists out there who feel like what they do is exactly right and it's perfect and there's nothing, they have no problem looking back at it. I'm just not one of them. I mean, to me, it's always like, you got to get better.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I passed it on to my son, you know, like he's a musician, but he's such a perfectionist about everything he does. And I feel like, God, I shouldn't have, you know, gotten on his case all the time about
Keith, I did the same thing with my daughter. I didn't do it on purpose, but one of my daughters is like slightly unhealthy perfectionist. Everything has to be like in its place, organized. Her grades have to be like 100% or, you know, or bust. And so we've now, and it just kind of like came about gradually until one day she sort of was like, what, I got 11. She got like some like 11 out of 12 on a test or something. And she was like freaking out, losing her mind about it. And we were like, whoa, 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 where is this coming from? So we've been working at like chilling her out a little bit, but she's still that way.
And then, by the way, it's one of the tough things about teaching. Like, occasionally I've taught classes.
Yeah.
Kids, like, from, and you know this, right? Because you have little ones. It's like the minute they start drawing, they draw that way where you don't show any looseness. Like, when I draw, I sketch, I use a lot of lines. I sketch it. Right. You know, I'm trying to find the line until I can commit to the one I like the best. A lot of kids will draw with one line. And, you know, and they'll draw a face, and if it doesn't work, then they erase it and they start again. And that need to, like, get it right, even in the first few seconds of doing a drawing, can be painful because you don't, you don't ever want to do it. And I'm always like, it's supposed to be kind of like easy. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be kind of like flow out of you. Not everything you're going to do is going to, you know, end up in, you know, in the, you know, in the mat.
There's so much toxicity that gets injected into our creativity. From like the comparison bug, from and understandably from like, well, I this has to look good, right? I mean, I can't express myself naturally if it looks like crap. Yeah. Like, what? Where does that leave me? Especially when I'm relying on illustration to pay my bills. I get that, But there is no such thing as perfect or the best. I mean, that's the lesson here. Like, another good example of this, going back to music, is John Prine.
Yeah.
Is he the best singer or guitar player? Absolutely not. And if you're a John Prine fan out there and you're like yelling at me, I'm sorry, I'm right. He's a good singer. He can play the guitar, but he's not the best. He's not the greatest. Bob Dylan, exactly the same thing. But those two are, by God, the most transcendent storytellers through their songwriting. It's the connection, like with John Prine's music, man, you just listen to him talk and just, you know, connect with the story. And that's the gold. That's where the good stuff is. Not in like his technical ability to like hit a note or strum a string.
Oh yeah,
look
at Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Another good example. When I was a kid, I didn't get him at all. But I got older, then I said, oh, I get it now. I see why he's great. I mean, when I was a kid, I thought Thelonious Monk, when I was like 16, I thought he was terrible. I thought he couldn't play the piano. Because he always uses all these blocky chords. If you ever seen him even on video, he often really uses his elbow sometimes.
Wow, you and I had the same. I heard him in college. So I was like maybe 18 or whatever. Maybe I was a couple years older than 16. I thought the same thing. First time I heard Thelonious Monk, I'm like, no thanks. I'll skip Monk.
Now in my mind, there's nobody above him, including Miles. You know, so yeah, I do. And it's all, again, it comes from not some sort of a perceived idea of polish and perfection. Even like somebody like the Beatles, I mean, the stuff I like about, my favorite album by them is White Album, because they seem a little more like they're just doing what they want, and they're not locked into, you know, coming out with hit singles or you know, they don't have as much flourishes on it, you know, with strings and orchestras that they did earlier in their career.
Did you see the documentary? The Beatles documentary?
You know what? I love them dearly, but that's a rough slog, man. I just don't have the time. I mean, I think the first episode was 3 hours.
No, I
loved it.
I know.
I loved it, and I really dug that you almost feel like you sat there and watched a guy write a genius song before your eyes. But I was like, can I keep doing this? Nah, I think I'd rather watch, I don't know, whatever the Marvel movie is.
Oh, wow, dude.
Well, that's bad. But
no, I hear you. No, I get it. But like, you don't have to watch the whole thing. But I think for anybody who you and I think we've basically hit this into the ground, this idea that you don't have to be the perfect or the best. But if there's anyone out there who's like, I don't know, really, I think you have to be, just watch 30 minutes, any 30 minutes of that documentary, any 30 minutes, and you will see the Beatles writing these songs. They are not in a perfect situation. Especially when they were in the warehouse prior to the studio, nothing was perfect about any of it.
Right.
And it was just like, I don't know, what do you think about this chord? Da, 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 da. Then, you know, and then Ringo's just kind of drumming along, and it's not like technically perfect. It's not, they are expressing themselves. They're using the influences from, you know, most of which from like American jazz artists and blues artists and other influences. They're using that and to find their own voices and then expressing it.
I actually think the boringness of it, the inside baseball of it, is the most appealing part to me.
Oh, heck yes.
That, you know, to see someone actually write a tune is not the same as listening to it. You know, we every time we turn on a radio, we're consuming tons of terrific music or not so terrific music, and we just see the results. To see what it really takes to write a good song is fascinating, because you realize it's hard work. These guys were blue collar, middle class guys, and the reason they put out so much music in such a short amount of time that was so good is because they put the hours in.
Right.
And even with what I do now, I mean, I assumed that I could do my first book because I had worked so hard, you know, all my life, just always drawing, always doing it. And maybe it was slightly arrogant of me to think I could do it. Or a friend of mine who was an illustrator told me a story. He teaches at FIT, and he was telling me, he goes, well, some of my students, come back to me and said they started to do a book, and they couldn't finish it. So the whole thing got canceled, and I was like,
wow, geez.
Holy shit, that's something that ain't going to happen to me.
No.
I'm going to finish this thing. Even if it sucks, I got to finish it. So
yeah.
I think just finishing something and getting it done, and he said, that's song one for the rest of Let It Be or Get It Back or whatever the album's going to be. And these guys worked. And also, they were perfectionists. They didn't just put on a bunch of crap. I mean, I'm sure they got lazy over time, but it's hard to create art. It's not easy. And every time I see anybody do anything, like even if it's a bad movie, I always have in the back of my mind, somebody worked really hard to get this thing made. And I respect them, even though I don't like the movie, but somebody worked hard.
Yep. Ditto. I don't pretend to know anything about music. I'm only reacting to what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing. It's not like I've studied any of this, but it's a reaction to it. And so, I think there are plenty of similarities between between music creation, illustration, all of that. But the bottom line is this: embrace your individuality, express it in a way that feels the operative word, feels right and natural to you. To heck with the rest. And I think that if people did that, the body of work they would end up creating would be a closer, if not exact, but closer representation of who they are in this freaking in the world, like who what their place is. That's how you separate yourself from the pack. That's how you get people's attention, not by, you know, worrying so much about how this illustrator is doing this or that illustrator is doing that. Like, screw all of that. Yeah, kind of have your finger on the pulse on all of it, sure. But at the end of the day, man, just good God.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I don't know if I've ever said this out loud in front of a group of people before, but part of the reason why I never really tried to pursue an illustration career until so late in life is because all the guys I really love, Bernie Fuchs, Prezzetta, you know, these really, really, really incredible illustrators. I knew I just never could do what they do. I don't have that kind of commitment or skill or talent. And these guys could do anything. They could do an album cover one day, and the next day they can do an ad for Coca-Cola, and the next day they'll do an ad for men's clothing.
Yeah,
and I knew
Portrait
I was
of JFK.
Be that guy.
Yeah.
Right. And I knew I wasn't going to be that guy, you know, or Bob Peake or somebody. You know, I knew. And I love all those guys. I have all their books of their works, and I was looking at them, and I'd pore over them. I'd say, oh, brilliant, 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 brilliant. The skill level is just beyond, you know, lighting and, you know, perspective.
Yeah.
And art, you know,
didn't
all
Bob
these
Peake
things.
Do those, like, Bond posters?
He did. And also Robert McGinnis used to do them, too, the early
oh,
work.
Oh, God, McGinnis.
Yeah, McGinnis. I love McGinnis. I mean, it doesn't look anything like what I do, but I love those guys. But I always, but somehow, even when I was in high school, I went to High School of Art and Design. I knew even then, some kids would go in that direction. I knew I was going to go that direction. So the only way I really know how to do what it is that I do is from what you just described, which is just whatever feels good to me, the way I want to do it, the way it feels comfortable. Doesn't mean I didn't spend a lot of time working on it to be as good at that as I could, because I was so intimidated by a lot of the really talented students, you know, and I still am. In the end, I feel like the only way I'm going to be able to feel good about what I do and get it out there and not feel like I'm not, you know, as good as these, you know, those greats, you know, the NC Wyatts and all that, is that I know I'm being honest and I'm doing what I do and I'm doing the best I can.
Oh my God. And like, I just see too many illustrators shun their own individual creativity. You know, it's like, well, what do you want to do? I want to do that. But I heard at a conference that someone told me that I need to look at the trends and I need to look at what's being published, which is fucking bullshit. Oh, yeah. Dude, I'm sorry. I need to turn down my rage knob here because I can feel it bubbling.
I know what you're saying because I'm not in it the way you are, but I kind of feel like I see certain styles, especially like on big accounts, you know, like for really well-known big companies and stuff, you know, like, and then I think, you know, Amazon or something, and you'll see like a certain illustration, this type of illustration, you see this, and it's really good stuff. It's very cool. It's, you know, somebody very talented did it, but at the same time, you'll see that same style again somewhere else, like another kind of an ad. And then you start seeing this language. It's like, okay, this is what's popular right now, this particular style, I'm not going to describe it, but it is what it is. And I feel like I'm never going to be one of those people. Mm-hmm. So I have to just hope that, you know, something happens with what I do. And sometimes I do, you know, you feel a little bit like, am I on the outside of things? You know, am I not, do I not have the desirable style, you know? And I'm sure that some of these great old illustrators, you know, that I've mentioned who are still working, you know, and I don't want to name names because I don't want to suggest that they're not popular, but people who used to be in every single annual, used to get tons of work, used to be everywhere, you're not seeing them as much. You're not getting as much work. The talent hasn't gone anywhere, but they're no longer part of the trend. And you can only hope that, you know, people appreciate how you do things, you know, because it's so subjective. Yeah. And also what the art directors think, you know, like, does that art director think what I do is interesting? It may think of my stuff. I remember I got weird stuff. I remember one time I was going to do, you know, a series of books on the cover. It's like, who is somebody? It's like a learning book for kids. It's like, who is Abraham Lincoln? Who is Martin Luther King?
Yes. With the big head. I was the art director.
You were art director on that?
Yeah.
Oh, I hope you're not the guy that I'll punch you in the nose because some guy I sent my work to.
Yeah, keep going. And, no, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I have to say, I mean, and it's really early on, and I sent something, and my agent sent it, and she just said, she came back, and she made a mistake of letting me see the whole line of the street, you know, the emails, and I saw what he had written, and it was really insulting, and it had a lot to do with my line, which to me is the only thing that makes me different, and, you know, and I was just like, he says his line stinks, he really needs to develop, please don't send these things to me anymore. And, you know, this was before Miles came out. And I was just like, if I had listened to that guy, I would have been super discouraged, you know? I assume it's not you.
Oh my God, dude. it was not, I don't know if it was me, but I was there. Cause if it's before Miles came out, this is 2017, 18.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember I told my agent, I said, you know, I'm not a really violent person, but I am a New York street kid, and I just want to give that guy a fat lip.
Hold on a second. And maybe it's not me. I have heart palpitations right now because I swear to God, if it was me, I would have just fucking die. But
well, I could tell you what the book is about, but I'm almost scared if I told you.
Go ahead. Let's just do it. Nope, we're doing
you
it.
Sure?
Full transparency. Let's roll.
But I have nothing but love for you now. So. It's all good. It's
Keith,
all good.
You would not be the first person that I said to somebody like, no, you don't have a career. You don't have a career in children's books. And then they actually did have a career and then became a friend of mine. So
it was Frederick Douglass.
Who was Frederick Douglass?
Yeah. And I did one sample illustration and they just tore it down. Like I shouldn't even be wasting the person's time. And they didn't know I was going to read it, by the way, to their credit. But I was just like, wow, if I didn't already have a book deal, I probably would have told my agent, I don't, you know, that's okay. I don't need to do this. In reality, everybody has takedowns. If I were an actor, I would have had 90,000 of them. So maybe I was a little bit too sensitive. But yeah, I was just like, dude, I get it, but you don't have to make me feel like I need to never pick up a pen again, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking this shit up, dude. I'm looking it up. I'm looking this up. I'm pretty sure I art directed it.
And I know those books were very successful. And even though it wasn't really along the lines of where I really wanted to go, it was still like a chance to get a gig and start breaking my way in. So, but in the end, it worked out because our book
So,
was
yeah,
okay received.
this is okay. So I'm looking at it. It was Who Was Frederick Douglass?
Right.
It was on sale December 26, 2014. I was the art director. I don't remember emailing. I mean, I wouldn't have said anything that rude or.
It doesn't sound right then. I remember they asked me to do a drawing. It was for one of those books, and they said it was Frederick Douglass. Unless it was like, is it possible that it could have been like some kind of a fake version of what you guys did, like a competing version or something?
Was it Penguin or Scholastic?
I don't remember what the publisher was, but I do. It was closer to like 16.
Yeah, the timing isn't right. So it could have been
Yeah, timing isn't
Scholastic
right.
because,
Yeah, they
not
do
to,
something similar.
they ripped it off
Oh,
huge.
okay.
They
Maybe that's
it's
what it
it, I don't
was
know
then.
if it's like who it wasn't. We
Even with
did
the big
who,
heads on the
yeah, we,
cover?
yeah. We did Who Was. It was Who Was, Who Is, What Is, What,
Oh, wow, that's
and they did something, I don't know what it was called. I am. Like, I am Frederick Douglass.
and by the way, I wasn't saying it to call anybody out, but it's just
That's amazing. I really want
what do
to.
you do when you get those things? I mean, listen,
Just.
every time you get offered a book, you don't know if you're going to get it. I just got a graphic novel that we haven't signed yet, so I guess I shouldn't say what it is. But I didn't think I was going to get it. They were looking
Right.
at a lot of people, but way more well known than me, and I just went and I said, let me go to on vacation, forget about it. And then I got back from vacation, and my agent called me and said they never wanted anybody but you the whole time. And all the rest of it was bullshit. And I was like, really? So
Amazing.
that for every one of those, you get about four or five of Frederick Douglass situations.
Oh
So
God, please. Like, definitely try and find out who it was. And if it was me, seriously, I would never write something that bad. But let's just say I was in a bad mood or so. I don't know, maybe I did. I don't know. D let me know, seriously, because I need to apologize. If it was me, I'm apologizing. I
hey,
can't.
what this reminds me of?
Yeah.
And this might have to go off, and you may have to edit this out really quick. But do you hear the podcast Dead Eyes?
No.
It's about how this actor once went to a audition for a movie that Tom Hanks was directing, and he heard from the casting director that the reason they didn't cast him in a role was because he had dead eyes. And then he went back. He created a whole podcast. It's over 100 episodes where he's trying to figure out what he meant by dead eyes. And he's asking all these other actors and producers and casting things. And the last episode, he asked Tom Hanks, and Tom Hanks is like, "Dude, I don't remember you. I don't remember it happening." He goes, "I don't even know if I said it. Maybe they said it and said I said it." But it's like one of those things, where not everybody can have the part. Not everybody can have the gig. So, I don't really hold back, but I remember things like that only from the point where, sometimes my sensitivity might have been weak that day, and then when you did it,
Sure.
I was like, I almost felt like, oh my gosh, maybe I'm fooling myself here.
We should definitely cut the chat short, sadly,
Sure.
because I mean we've been talking for a while, and I like this is I can feel it, man. This is the kind of conversation that you and I could roll for another 2.5 hours, and it'll be
Absolutely, man.
easily,
Absolutely.
kind of like a little improvisation jazz situation here. But there are folks listening who are jazzed about illustration. how to do it. How to connect with people through it. What would be one last piece of advice that you would want to share with them directly?
Whatever story or whatever it is you're trying to tell or whatever you're trying to communicate, try to think not only how you see it, but also how other people are going to see it. I think when I do books, particularly, I try to imagine what kind of book, and this might be kind of cliche, but I try to imagine the kind of book I want to read. Miles Davis is huge for me because there's never been a children's book done about Miles Davis before. And I really wanted to just be the coolest thing in the world when I was like 6 years old and someone handed me a Miles Davis kids book. So I wanted to look the way I wanted to look. And I think everything I do is I just try to make it look cool. And I just wanted to look different and special. So even if someone doesn't dig it, they'll say, they'll now be able to say, this looks just like something else I've seen. So I think, like we've been hammering, you know, don't try to do it in such a way that you think you've seen it done before, or done in a way that somebody you admire has had success with, but just take that chance, because to just sell yourself, because even if it's just a few people in the beginning, in the end, a lot of people are going to dig it if it's really good.
To learn more about Keith, visit keithhenrybrown.com. Instead of my usual closing, I want to tell you that the Illustration Department's Memorial Day sale is coming up. From May 27th through May 30th, all offerings led by me will be 15% off. That includes our popular mentorships, the 3-week illustration and picture book workshops, the 1-hour portfolio review, and more. To take advantage of this rare sale, visit illustrationdepartment.com/classes. That's illustrationdept.com/classes. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast, and I hope to see you.